Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here. Home studio, Pond City Market, Atlanta. And today, everybody, boy, this was a fun one. I had my buddy Raymond Carr in here. And Raymond, I got to know, he's a local Atlanta. He wears a lot of hats. He's a filmmaker. He is an art director and production designer for TV and film. And most notably, he is a puppeteer. So this is my first puppeteer, and hopefully not my last one. But Raymond was the production designer for the Stuff You Should Know TV show that we shot here for Science Channel a few years ago. And if you saw that movie and you saw the office sets and everything, we built all that, and Raymond was the guy behind it. And he's just a valued member of the Atlanta film community, has been for a long time, and just a really cool guy and friend. And it was good to catch up with him because he's a busy dude. And we haven't seen each other for a little while. So aside from Facebook keeping up, it's been a minute. So Raymond came in today, and it was a really, really great conversation. The insight that he has on the craft of puppeteering is just astounding. So if you're a fan of Muppets and puppets and creature shops and things like that, then this is going to be right up your alley. I learned so much. Just from talking to Ray for just the short time that we were in here together. And it was also cool just to get to know Raymond better. I point out early in the episode that, you know, you work together on film sets sometimes and you're with each other a lot, but I didn't know a ton about his background. So it was very interesting, to say the least, his upbringing. Not the usual thing. So his pick was Labyrinth from 1986, of course, the classic Jim Henson production that written by Terry Jones of Monty Python fame, produced by George Lucas, and really, really good movie starring the late, great David Bowie. And it was really good stuff. I got to watch it this morning, and it was really cool to hear all Raymond's stories of how it all works, and really got a new appreciation for his craft and the craft in this film. So here we go with Raymond Carr on Labyrinth. I'm excited about this because we worked together like very closely for what, a couple of months?
Yeah.
And you know, when people work on a film production, those of you listening, it's very intensive. Like you're around each other, like, you know, each other's smells and everything. But sometimes you don't know like small things like where you're from. And I think you're from LA, right?
Yeah, I'm with Southern California. I moved around a lot. Like we, growing up, we moved like six times for no explicit reason. Like, so I was born in Azusa, which is kind of like out in the desert.
Yeah,
and then like, Rialto and then Pomona. And then when I was like in my early teens, I moved to Inglewood, California. And Inglewood is like, we were like a block away from the LA riots, which was a great story. just because it was.
How old were you then?
I couldn't have been more than 11.
Wow.
It was probably like, my brother's 2 years older than me, so it was probably like 10, 11 in that range. And at the time we had our two best friends with us.
Yeah.
And we're both black, obviously. And my two best friends were white.
And they were living with you guys?
No, they just were visiting.
Oh, okay.
And they're both our, like, same age range. And,
right.
Like, they were our neighbors, and they moved up north. And so, you know, when you're, like, that age and you haven't seen your best friends in a long time, it's just chaos.
Yeah.
It's chaos. So my brother and four boys were just, like, horseplaying and stuff. And, like, the city was just going mad around us.
Yeah.
And at one point, my mom just came in and was like, you guys aren't allowed to watch TV tonight.
Right.
It was all like preemptive.
Wow.
And then around 1 a.m., they all like hustled us into a car and we had to drive away.
Did you get the fuck out of town?
Yeah. My parents had to put blankets over my friends' heads.
Wow.
Just so nobody could see that they were white. As we drove out of South Central LA.
Man, that's a script.
Yeah.
And I remember, that's a movie.
I remember very distinctly, like, I don't have negative memories about it because I was just a kid and it was, like, fun and whatever. And, like, there were tanks, not tanks, but, like, Army Reserves was called out and everything. And so we were like, oh, like G.I. Joes.
Right, right.
And, like, driving over the freeway. And, like, I remember looking to my right and there was just the city lights of LA. And then looking to my left, just, like, fire. just like sprinkles of fire.
Holy shit,
and
man.
We couldn't get back in there, our neighborhood for another like week. My dad had to like come in and show his driver's license because his whole area was just like armed guards.
Right.
Like you couldn't get in.
So you had to live there to get back.
Yeah, exactly.
And did you even know if your house was like standing?
In hindsight, probably not. Because, I mean, we didn't have the internet or any sort of, or cell phones or
but
anything.
But as a kid, you're not probably aware of that stuff.
Yeah, I didn't care about that. I mean, it didn't register. I cared about it. It just didn't register.
Yeah, yeah, of
course. The gravity of the situation. And except until I got home and like the mom and pop shop where we would go to get toys and candies was just burned out. It was like a car upside down, just charred out.
Wow.
And that stayed that way for the better part of a year.
My brother was out there during the riots. He was a DGA trainee then. Mm. But he was like living out in like a Burbank or something. Mm-hmm. What did your folks do? Were they in the business at all?
No. So I don't think you know about this, my history going into the puppet things, but we were homeschooled by church clowns.
Just say that sentence one more time for everyone at home.
We were homeschooled by church clowns.
Wow. There's a
I
lot to unpack
there. I can't
believe
you didn't know this about
me. I knew you had a unique history. And yeah. That's why I think I thought your dad was in entertainment somehow, because mm-hmm. I knew there was some unique Raymond Carr, like what made Raymond Carr was a unique situation.
Yeah, that's you could say that. All right. So my parents were clowns, Holy the Clown and Mr. Bigfoot. My mother was a white-faced clown and my dad was a hobo clown.
Okay.
And we performed in churches and schools across America. And my brother and I would do puppets. Behind this PVC pipe stage with velour curtains. And my parents would do sketches and gospel illusions, not magic, mind you, because magic is,
of the devil.
Is of the devil. And it was all in the, like, we were basically the children's entertainment for, and we grew up in mega churches. The church I grew up in had 14,000 members.
Wow.
Yeah. And at the height of it, we were performing 200 times a year.
Really?
So we would travel the country and perform.
And your parents taught you?
And I was homeschooled my whole life. Uh-huh. So like the church clowning stuff came in after. It was kind of like a convenience insert to our lives.
So how old are you during this period? Are you?
So my parents like always followed us in church, like being our Sunday school teachers.
What denomination?
Non-denominational, okay. Word of faith, money people. That
gotcha.
Kind of stuff. Yeah. And all the people you see on TV that everybody makes fun of.
Right.
they followed us like from, you know, the preschool stuff into grade school stuff. And then the church planning thing just came out of like trying to get kids' attention. And
right.
Just trying to make and we had like our services were like 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Like 3-4 hours long. And then you never knew how long they were going to go. So. Uh-huh. It was almost vaudevillian in the way, because we had these set sketches that we would do, but we never had any scripts for them. We just kind of, my mom would just like write down like little bullet points. Okay, we're going to do, you know, Ties and Old Fins and Word Bird and Fire Dog and all this kind of stuff. We knew the sketches that were attached to those
things. That
is
so cool.
Yeah.
Now, did you have was it just the four of you, or were there other kids doing like as part of the show or
there's
adults?
An entire world underneath the society that exists to facilitate these things. No, seriously, like
that's a script too. The Raymond Carr story.
We worked for a company that sold a lot of puppets and mm-hmm. clowning ministries and curriculum and all that kind of stuff. Well, I worked for them. My parents were independent. But my dad worked for UPS for 25 years.
Okay.
And then,
so that was the day job.
Yeah, the day job. And then on the weekends, we would do this thing. And then sometimes he was pretty vested, so he could take a lot of time off. And then he went into early retirement and then mm-hmm. did it full time. And this is actually how we moved to Georgia, because my parents got a job out here when I was still in high school.
So you were mid-teens or something?
Yeah, I was 16.
Okay.
So I came out here kicking and screaming.
What part of town?
I moved from Santa Monica, California, to Union City, Georgia, which, if you know,
talk about a culture shock.
Yeah, if you know Georgia, it's essentially south of the airport.
Yeah.
Where they didn't get the memo that the South lost.
Right.
just information just did not trickle down.
Yeah, yeah, it's probably still a little bit that way, sadly.
So, we moved out there to another mega church that had 25,000 members.
Wow, man.
Yeah, yeah.
That is. I mean, I've heard of megachurches. You know, I grew up Southern Baptist mm-hmm. in the sort of typical Stone Mountain, whatever, I don't even know, 500 or 600 people on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And I knew about mega churches, but I didn't know that they were that big.
Yeah, bro. That's like...
That's stadium shit.
Yeah. They had the I grew up in a church that was called the Faith Dome, and it was a dome.
Uh-huh.
And they had, like, writing on the parking lot grounds that you could see from the airport, because it was near the airport. So you mm-hmm. could see... Like, it was in the lane of... So you could see the title of the thing on the top of the building.
Oh, like when you flew in?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we moved to here, and there was another dome. So mm-hmm. domes seem to be a thing.
Right.
I guess it's just maximum amount of people. But
sure.
Yeah.
Wow. So you were doing puppetry. And it's funny, because I remember, now that you mentioned that, I had totally forgotten my church had a puppet program.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess, I mean, this was in the 80s for you, but 70s/80s, because mm-hmm. you're younger than me, but just that time period, it was
a bigger
thing than it is now, it seems like.
Well, I mean, it's...
Because we had a youth group did puppet shows and
stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think it still exists. You know, just the way that we consume information and just entertaining kids, you know, everything is just amped up.
Right.
So, but I will say that, like, there were churches that had just ginormous theatrical productions with puppets that were just out of control. Months of choreography and stage lighting and all that kind of stuff.
Like real deal stuff.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So shit got real.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that answers the question then. You've been doing this your whole life then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much a... Got to stick with it at this point.
Yeah.
And got nothing better to do.
Well, and then you eventually got into film work, and this is the least interesting part of your narrative at this point, whereas most people would be like, oh, very cool, like production designer and art mm-hmm. director. But you were that's a bill-paying gig, or was, I guess.
Yeah,
I
still do. I'm the type of person that I say I have creative ADD. So, uh-huh. like, whenever I'm doing one thing, I'm always like, oh, I want to do that other thing, too. So I've always liked to build and to work with my hand. I'm a good problem solver and that kind of stuff. So when I always knew that I wanted to work in film, well, not uh-huh. always, but I wanted to do work in entertainment in some form or another.
Right. You didn't want to work in an office.
Well, I think I did until I realized that other people actually made a living as an entertainer. Because uh-huh. like my parents, even though we were performing and entertaining, we didn't, my parents didn't consider themselves artists. Nobody, I didn't know any artists.
Right. But they were, which is
kind of
the funny part.
Right. And I remember some girl in like our homeschool group mentioned, we were all talking about what we wanted to do. And she was like, oh, I want to be a painter. And I just, it blew my mind. I was like, wait, what? Like
that can be a job.
That's a thing people do?
Yeah.
So it wasn't until I moved out to Atlanta and I got involved in the Center for Puppetry Arts, which is an amazing theater and museum here in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
It's the largest puppetry theater in the country, one of the largest in the world, and it has a ginormous Jim Henson exhibit right now.
I went about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, including a bunch of Labyrinth puppets, which will...
Yeah.
So I started working there, and that's when I started getting involved in the theater scene. I was like, oh, wait, people are actually making a living,
right.
using air quotes.
Yeah. So in high school, you started
high
over
school.
There?
Yeah.
Wow. And was it just serendipity that your parents moved to Atlanta, or did it have anything to do with the...
I think it was a part of a bargaining chip. I think it was, I don't think it was like directly, like we lived a very modest life in mm-hmm. LA, you know, and then just by the nature of cost of living, when they moved to Georgia, it like skyrocketed in what we were able to afford and do.
Right.
And my dad, you know, was working UPS and doing other odd jobs and stuff.
That's
and
the like, only good thing about moving to Union City from Santa Monica.
Exactly. You know? They moved to a house that was like three times the size of the ones that we grew up in, and uh-huh. they bought a Lexus and stuff like that.
Right.
Church money stuff. And so I think it was more so like, okay, we can do this thing that we've always wanted to do, and maybe they'll shut up a little bit more if they can hang out at the Puppet Center.
Right.
Or at least they can justify their conscience.
That's great. I mean, we're so lucky to have that here in Atlanta.
Absolutely.
And I grew up going there with on school trips and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a dumb little kid who wasn't into that, it was just a field trip to me.
Yeah, sure.
But now that I'm an adult and I go and I take my daughter, you know, for the first time, it's and they've redone it. And when did they do that? A few years ago?
Yeah, it's been like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, it's just amazing now.
Yeah.
And just such a, like, great facility, and, the show we saw was amazing.
They spend millions of dollars on production every year.
Wow.
Yeah. They're one of the largest theaters in Atlanta, period, puppetry or not. They're one of the highest paying theaters for performers.
Oh,
in
wow,
Atlanta.
That's great.
Yeah, like you can make a living as a puppeteer there, as a performer there.
That's
you know?
Great.
And it's great because you do your shows in the, during the day and then you have time at night. And then they also have a great adult program as well for, you know, just adult theater and what have you. So, yeah, so I started working at the center, and then I was working around, I was cast in the show, and I was thinking I was going to be a theater major, and then I looked around, and all of my castmates had, like, master's degrees in theater, and I was, starting college, and I was like, well, maybe, since I'm already doing the thing that I want to do with theater, try something else.
School.
Yeah, so I started, I went to Georgia State and got
just a film degree?
Film degree.
Nice. What about your brother? Was he getting into it as well, or?
He stayed in the church longer than I did. He was a little... He was a holdout.
Gotcha. Did you almost say hostage? No.
Dude, this is not a podcast about post-church therapy sessions, but we could deep dive.
Yeah, we should have our own sideshow.
No, but he was there for a while and was like a youth pastor for a while, but then he got out, thankfully, and now he's actually the marketing director at Dad's Garage, which is an awesome local improv theater. One of the largest improv theaters in Atlanta and most prestigious.
That's great. So he still had that creative juice.
Yeah, yeah. And he's in the ensemble now, and he's actually producing his first stage play there.
Awesome.
It's The Diary of a Black Nerd. It's fun.
Did he write it?
He wrote and produced it.
Oh, that's great.
And he also wrote another play, Wrath of Khan, which is about Dragon Khan.
Oh, cool.
Which is another nerd con out here.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he's doing fine.
Are your folks in Georgia still?
They're in, they actually, ironically enough, moved back to L.A. To work for the church that we grew up in, actually.
So they're there now.
Yeah, they are.
Well, let's get into the hints and stuff, because we work together. Well, people should know really quickly, the Center for Puppetry Arts is also where we had the Stuff You Should Know premiere party and viewing and stuff like that, which I hadn't been there in so many years when I went. And that's what kind of re-turned me on, if that's a thing that people say, turned me on to it again, was seeing Emmett Otter in person.
Yeah.
Because that was my jam when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Muppet Show and the Muppet movie. But Emmett Otter was just, and still holds such a, like, really, really special place in my heart.
Right, right.
You know? So I saw the Emmett Otter and Ma there in person that night. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, it kind of, like, moved me. I was like, oh, I'm going to start coming here again.
Yeah.
And then when we got our daughter, of course, it's a great place to, you know, buy the membership. And
absolutely.
Just spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
After Stuff You Should Know.
Right.
You were the production designer for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then not too long after, you got the phone call. Is that how it works?
There's just a bat phone.
It's a fuzzy green.
Yeah, exactly. Every puppeteer has one installed into their house. No. So like, just recap. I kind of went from the center, did a bunch of shows there. And then I worked on the show called Lazy Town. Which was for Nick Jr. As a puppeteer, and that took me to Iceland, actually.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah, I worked. Spent a year in Iceland working on that show, and it was several years ago, so some people might remember it, but it's a sports superhero thing.
Uh-huh.
And then I came back into town, and then I went on tour for a while with a show called Walking with Dinosaurs, which is life-size animatronic dinosaurs. We played arenas. The height of it, we were the third largest touring show in the world.
Really?
Yeah. So it was like Springsteen, U2, and us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We traveled with 25 semi-trucks and like 75 people playing.
Just all over the world?
North America was our tour. So they've been to the world, over the world since. But so we did Canada, Mexico, and the States. And we played like Madison Square Garden and like Staples Center. And
man,
everywhere.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it was great. And then I started my own production company out here and do a bunch of commercials and,
Ninja
Puppet Productions.
That's right.
And doing pilots, lots of pilots.
Yeah.
So many pilots. And then started working on built a bunch of stuff for the Georgia Aquarium, and we got a good run of like weird clients too. Uh-huh. Where like Dropbox, we did some puppet stuff for Dropbox.
Really?
Yeah, we had this whole. It was great. We did this whole like recruitment video where they recorded their staff,
uh-huh.
like why they loved working at Dropbox, and we built puppets of their staff, and then we flew out to San Francisco and then shot around their offices as puppets.
Wow.
Like, lip syncing to their voiceovers.
I guess that's the funny thing with puppets. Like, you never yeah. know who's going to call
yeah.
and say, well, we thought we'd try this thing.
Yeah. We did some stuff with MailChimp, who's uh-huh. your friends here. And then I went to Henson every now and again. They kind of recruit oftentimes out of workshops
mm-hmm.
where they'll have an invite-only workshop and they'll go through a couple of weeks or however much time. And they'll teach you their
right.
way of doing things.
But what they really do is it's kind of a little farm league or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, they always say, this is not an audition. This is not an audition. By the way, this is not an audition.
But everyone's thinking, oh my God, it's the audition.
And then it turns into an audition.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the reality is it wasn't an audition.
Uh-huh.
But soon after there, I did have an audition. There was like 300 people that applied to it. And then me and a couple other people got in and spent a couple of weeks in LA training with them. And they were mostly interested in like the improv aspect of it too. Cause they have, uh-huh. they have a puppet improv team actually,
wow.
Puppet Up, which is a lot of fun. And it's cool, really cool. Cause they do improv and then they also do, sketches from like Jim Henson's old TV spots. Like,
oh, wow.
Stuff he used to do on the Ed Sullivan Show and stuff like that. They recreate.
So you're working a lot of muscles there, because not only does your game have to be on as a puppeteer, but then you're improvising.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to have your shit
yeah.
down
yeah.
as a comedian.
Right. Well, because that's what, I mean, the Puppet Up started because Brian Henson, Jim's oldest son,
mm-hmm.
felt like the Muppets were losing the like improvisational aspect of it
right.
of the original show that like Jim and Frank Oz used to do.
Right.
And so he wanted to like get some like some cool Hollywood improv people to get mm-hmm. come in and like bust it out. And so that's what they did. And then they created this whole program and they'd had a Vegas show for a while and tours. They still tour. I'm still on the roster. I don't know. I'm waiting. That's the other call I'm waiting for at any moment.
Oh, really? To get called up to the bigs?
Yeah.
I think I've heard of that. That yeah, sounds really familiar.
It's great. It's a great show. You can see. They had a show on TBS for a while, too.
Uh-huh.
And then they wanted me to audition for a role for their new show, which is called Splashing Bubbles,
uh-huh.
which is on PBS right now. And it's a oceanography show.
Oh, cool.
And it uses their HDPS system, which is Henson Digital Puppetry System.
All right, explain that.
Yeah, okay. So they basically use the animatronic interfaces, some of which they developed on the Labyrinth,
mm-hmm.
Except instead of using animatronics, it articulates CG characters.
Okay.
So I have my hand inside of what looks like a mouth plate of a traditional puppet, like a mm-hmm. hand and Muppet style puppet, and then has sensors all over it. My forearm is kind of jigged to a gyroscope where I can move it up and down and all around and whatever.
That's badass.
And my fingertips have little controllers around them too, so I can articulate different fingertips
uh-huh.
and as well as my thumb. And then on my left hand, I have a joystick with a series of toggles on it for each individual finger. And then the thumb cup that goes over my thumb that basically rotates independently. And then I can twist it, and I can push it forward, left, right, uh-huh. forward, backwards, and then a series of foot pedals. And all of that that I just explained to you
yeah.
is just to operate the face of the puppet.
Wow.
So my left hand is all just the eyebrows uh-huh. and the blinks and all that kind of stuff. And like animatronics, you have little motors in the cheeks or in the lips or
yeah.
and those all work in concert together to make uh-huh. a smile,
right.
you know, these different points of actuation. And so you have digital points of actuation on the CG character. And so when I move my hand and I move my fingertips, I am able to manipulate the lips moving and the pursing of the lips and the tongue moving and all that stuff.
Holy shit.
To articulate movement. And then we do this, so there's a bank of these things, usually four or six of these programs, and mm-hmm. I'm looking into a monitor, two monitors, one
right.
with my character's face on it, and then another one with a digital feed of what the cameras are seeing. And then on the floor in front of me, there's like about a 500 square foot padded floor that has sensors all around it. Mm-hmm. And because we're fish, this was a fish puppet show. There are people on the floor that have basically rod puppets. Mm-hmm. They look like fish with a rod sticking out of it.
Yeah.
And they hold it almost like a gun. And they have like little toggles on the fish's body that moves the fins and different things in the body. And we work in concert together to basically make a digital show.
Wow.
And the benefit of this is, if anybody knows anything about animation, we were pumping out a 15-minute episode every day.
Yeah, which is nuts.
Yeah. Like, and it was, there was some rendering after that, but like they were cutting it live. Uh-huh. It was like three cameras. So they were just switching back and forth like a live program.
What's the learning curve like on a system like that for you?
It was intense.
I mean, is it weeks or months or?
I had about a week and a half.
Once you got your hands in there, was it a familiar thing or was it like, man, I got to like start from scratch brain wise?
You know, it's one of those things where like, if you learn to throw, I'm not a sports ball guy, but I've heard if you're trying to learn to throw a curveball, that's a thing, right?
Sure.
and you're just like a natural, like, oh, I've played baseball and I know how to throw a ball.
Uh-huh.
And you're like really good at that thing. And then they're like, okay, let me teach you how to throw a curveball. And then your brain resets and you can't throw again for a while.
Right.
It's kind of like that where you have to like, it's built by performers for performers.
Uh-huh.
This is the same system that they used on that show Dinosaurs and Ninja Turtles back in the 90s.
Right.
So it's almost the same thing, except you have to just reset your brain a little bit. Like, I could get into the details. A lot of the stuff is online, so I encourage everybody to like actually deep dive into the HDPS system, and some of it's on my website and whatever.
I'm sure there'll be some Googling going on.
Yeah, definitely Google it because it's a beautiful synthesis of it's designed for performers.
Right.
So it takes a second to like get your brain into it, but it is for performers.
Right.
Which is
so cool.
The best thing about working with Henson is that they are all, it's all in service to the performance and to the character. Everything.
Right. While being on the leading edge, I'm sure, of kind of everything.
Yeah.
Puppets.
Yeah. Oh, puppets and also just like entertainment. A lot of their stuff that they do right now is animation.
Mm-hmm.
They have an animation studio.
Are they still there on La Brea?
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you walking in that joint for the first time?
So the Jim Henson Company, they own the lot, one of Charlie Chaplin's lots that's celebrating its like 100th year anniversary. And you see, like, Charlie Pratt Chaplin's footprints and little signature in the concrete.
Oh, I remember, like, for those of you who have ever seen it in L.A., you know what I'm talking about. But if you've not been and you visit L.A., I encourage you to go at least drive by. Like, Kermit literally looms as large over the entrance right there in the middle of Hollywood. Dressed as Charlie Chaplin. And it really just, like, evokes magic.
Yeah.
Just driving by and looking at it.
And this is also the old A&M building where they, like, recorded everything. We Are the World was recorded
there.
That's
right. I think I knew that.
Like, and it's still a functioning studio. So
sound
like,
studio? Uh-huh.
Yeah. In between breaks, there was like Justin Timberlake would be there and Paul McCartney. And
wow.
Yeah. Everybody was there. And like where we would record our songs was in that recording studio. So.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So I imagine you go in there as a guy who's been doing puppet work his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
This is the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing bigger, right, than Henson?
Yeah. I mean, well, it depends on what you consider big, but yes. Like, I think that it's the most prestigious, I would say.
Right.
The most prestigious and consistently prestigious and respected and everything else. It's like, it's what you want to do.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
It was a mind job. It was an amazing experience. And we did a full season and everybody wants to do a second season, so hopefully we'll be back.
Cool. And what's it on?
It's on PBS.
Nice.
Yeah, and Netflix. PBS, Netflix, all the platforms, but it's consistently. New episodes are still coming out on PBS and on Netflix as well.
So once you're in there, though, are you like, is it likely that they'll just call you for other stuff now?
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess you'd have to talk to them more than anything else. But they do use, I mean, they've invested a certain amount of time and effort into you as a performer.
Right.
So they like to, you know, it's not the type of thing where you can just get somebody off the street to do this.
Sure.
And there are a handful of people. I mean, there is a lot of people. There's always way more people wanting to do the thing that you want to do than you think.
That's
it's like, I'm going to be a professional juggler. How hard can it be? And then there's like 150 people trying to do the same job. So, yes, there are. And I do voices that are, you know, I have a range of voices that I like to do. My character is Dunk the Pufferfish. He's usually the comic relief, but then I have another character that is a stingray that's much deeper vocal range. So I can go pretty broad in that way.
Can you give us a sample? Yeah.
So Dunk the Pufferfish talks like this. Welcome to Reef Town, which is where we live. Yeah.
And what about the other guy?
Mayor Sting is more like this. He's a little bit of Duff Man.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's awesome, man. So you've like I said, about working a lot of muscles. I mean, I think people, I'm glad you're on because I don't think people understand the breadth of the talent of a puppeteer because there's so many things have to be on point from vocalization to movement. It's like really pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's all, you know, focused on making a character come to life and having a connection with the audience that is going to resonate and stand the test of time, you know?
Yeah. And for you, like, as far as, like, when I went to the Puppetry Art Show, you know, we walked my daughter around, showed her all the stuff, like the great exhibit right now, the hints and stuff that's there. And then we went to the show, which was amazing, and the first, like, legit puppet show I've been to since I was a kid. And the joy of, as a parent, to, you know, look over at your, like, you're looking at your kid half the time because you want to just see them delight in that.
Yeah, sure.
But, like, for you, like, you don't have kids.
No.
What? How does that figure in? Like, I'm sure bringing that joy to children is a big part of it, though, right?
You know, it's funny. I've worked in children's entertainment most of my life, all of my life,
I hate children.
Yeah, I can't stand them. No, but it's so much more of a selfish thing for me.
Really?
Like,
it's just about the art of it.
Puppetry is live action cartoons. You can do anything on stage or on screen that is just absurd and your imagination can run wild and all that stuff. So there's a lot of nostalgia that is attached to puppetry, but it's never really been nostalgic for me because it's just been a way of expression.
Right.
I grew up as a very shy and timid kid.
Really?
Yeah. And I always say puppetry is theater for the timid. You know, I always wanted to express myself. I had a creative bone. Like, we did, like, stupid VHS videos and ourselves and all kinds of stuff. But I never had the courage to actually be in front of people. And that's why I really gravitated towards puppetry is because I could.
I guess it kind of makes sense. You throw in that black turtleneck and hide behind that curtain.
Seriously, even if you're in front of the stage, just having something that is, like, that one step removed from the audience to you makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
So
that's very cool. You'd be a good dad, Raymond. I don't want to like.
Thanks, Mom.
I'm sure you're getting that. What about movies in general growing up? Like, was that a big thing in your household?
Well, not like particularly. My brother and I. It's funny. I've been digitizing all these old VHS tapes, recently, and my brother and I used to take our favorite clips and music videos from movies that we would rent and then record them onto one singular VHS tape.
Yeah, it was
just like
YouTube.
In a montage. Uh-huh. Yeah, our own personal YouTube that we would just play on nauseam. And so, maybe it's just because we had had a lot of imagination, a lot of time to kill. Like we loved movies, and we would geek out about movies, but we didn't grow up in a movie house. Like, my dad liked action movies or whatever. And because we were so religious, I'm sure you experienced too, it was like...
Fairly limited range.
Well, yes and no. Like, no sex, bad language is bad, but like, violence, sure.
I know, man. USA, baby.
Yeah, so like, I loved action movies and adventure movies and... You know, growing up in the 80s, I was a total kid of that era of just, you know, traveling to space and Space Camp and Flight of the Navigator and
Space Camp. I love that
Last Starfighter and like all that stuff, man.
Yeah.
I think Flight of the Navigator is probably, and that's kind of how I like gravitated towards puppetry to a certain extent because I loved you know, hints and stuff, but no more than any normal kid who grew up watching Sesame Street.
Yeah,
and
we all
the Muppets and all this stuff. Like, so what really attracted to me was the sci-fi creature stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been, that was the first thing that like made me realize that this is something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, I want to do that. And I don't know what that is, but I want to make creatures. And I wasn't even like into scary stuff. Like, ironically enough, like Child's Play was the scariest thing. Like anytime they made a sequel and a trailer would come on TV every couple of years, I would just be like, nope, closing my eyes and just having nightmares during the course of the run of those trailers coming through television.
Did you see Ready Player One yet?
I did.
That was a pretty great moment with Chucky, actually. And I didn't watch any of the Chucky movies, but that one got me in the theater.
Yeah, that movie, I'm really not a nostalgia guy. Like, even though I work in like nostalgic
central
concepts, but like, I just like the things that they did, you know, and even as a, you know, I make movies as well, sci-fi movies and creature movies.
Right.
And because I have a production design background and a puppetry background, I can build miniatures and creatures and stuff like that for my own stuff.
So cool, man.
But it's less about like, I'm doing it practical because that's the only way to do it.
Right.
It's more so I'm doing it practically because A, I can do it.
Uh-huh.
And B, I like creating these worlds with my hands.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, yeah.
What for puppetry is building the puppet like half of the joy of it all? Like literally constructing it?
No. So I'm not nearly as good as a puppet builder as other people that I know.
Oh, really?
So I will build puppets, but I come in when with my company, like we'll get a job, and I will assess the situation. I'll make a bid. I will R&D the situation. And most people come to me and have no idea how to do a thing with puppets.
Right.
And so I will see what they want to do and then make suggestions. I know enough about production and puppets and production design to know how to tackle this giant chicken destroying a city that you want to have for your commercial.
Yeah. You know? I imagine production design is a good, even just budgeting stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
The nuts and bolts of it.
Exactly. So I will come in from there and then I'll come up with a bunch of designs or hire another designer that needs to, if it needs to be more specific.
Yeah.
And then from there we will, then I'll hire out the people. It's like, okay, this thing is, you know, fabric heavy. So I need a good puppet builder that works with fabrics. This one's a creature thing, so I need silicone-based sculptor, that kind
of
stuff.
So you've got your roster of specialties almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's very cool. One of the things that struck me, and we might as well go ahead and get into Labyrinth, because that's where it sort of segues here, is when I was watching it, and I had never seen Labyrinth.
Really?
I watched it this morning. No, I mean, it came out in 86, so I was 15, so I might have been just a little too old in that shitty mid-teenager thing setting in.
And it's Bowie, and it's like pop and like whatever.
Yeah, so I don't think I'd ever seen it, but watching it, like, it really, it ages well, or it ages better than the CG, or not CG, but the special effects movies from that time.
Yeah,
because it really hit me today that, and it made me think of going to the Center for Puppetry Arts and seeing Big Bird and like feeling like a fucking 5-year-old again.
Yeah.
It's because it's a thing that moves through space in 3 dimensions.
Right. Yeah.
It's not, it can't age.
Right.
It's not like, oh, Big Bird. He's like, it's sort of dated looking.
Right. Yeah.
No, it's Big Bird. He's the same then as he is now. When you see it in person, especially like on a display, and it's so huge and like colorful and like it looks amazing, looks brand new.
Yeah. You're not trying to trick anybody.
Yeah.
Like the thing about what a lot of CG does is it's trying to make a photorealistic version of a thing that you think that it might look like.
Yeah,
even
simulation.
If the thing doesn't actually exist, it's a monster that and it moves and they're trying to get the movement and the lighting and the texture so accurate to what you think a monster might look like.
Right.
But that wasn't the goal of the creature design in the Labyrinth stuff.
Right.
It was creature fantasy things. And, you know, and Jim, the thing that I love about Jim Henson, and like I'm a Jim Henson fan because of the man, not necessarily because of all the quirky characters that he created. Like I'm a fan of his business acumen. I'm a fan of him just as an artist. Like he became one of the most famous people in the world, mm-hmm. and at his heart was still just like a pure artist.
Yeah.
That was like perfect synthesis of like being a shrewd businessman,
yeah.
an artist, and not an asshole.
Yeah. I mean, we did a Stuff You Should Know episode. Well, we did one on the Muppets and one on Henson specifically, mm-hmm. and he was just a good person.
Yeah.
You know, it threw out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking, I always want to like see a movie about him, but there would be very little.
But do you?
Well, I kind of do. I always think
you would be so.
I always think it would be like, okay, it would be cool if, but you know. But the problem is like the central conflict. There's not like he didn't have. It wasn't a Steve Jobs thing where he was having these outbursts. And
I know it's hard to make a movie without a it's not to say he wasn't complex, but he was a pretty pure-hearted guy.
Well, I will say though the big thing, if there is like a central conflict that would be moved in the movie, would be the level of him trying and failing,
right?
Because the Labyrinth was not a success.
Yeah, and that would probably be the story.
And neither was the Dark Crystal.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if you just as like a little backstory within this, like the Dark Jim Henson was doing the Muppet Show.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that people really can understand how big the Muppet Show was at the time.
It was huge.
Like, this is back when you still had, like, very few television networks screening things. So, like, to have a big show back then meant that everybody was watching it.
Yeah, it was appointment television.
Yeah, and, like, not just, like, everybody, but around the world. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of shows didn't always translate internationally. This was everywhere.
Yeah.
And he stopped it. Like, he decided to not do it anymore after, like, five seasons, I think, just because he felt stagnant as an artist. And that is something that artists do, is they push themselves for the next thing, you know?
Right.
And the next thing he wanted to do was this thing called the Dark Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of worked a little ass backwards trying to get the design work and then, like, he built out the world, and then he started to incorporate the story in the world.
Right.
And then that was essentially, it did okay. It was also just a ginormous, expensive movie that like it, no people in it. It's the first theatrical, like all puppet movie.
Yeah. Cause the Muppet Show, the Muppet movie, Labyrinth. I mean, they all had, humans interacting.
Right. And it was, you know, it was dark. It was, you know, fantasy. And Jim said, like, he would say that, like, it's a good thing to scare kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's a good part of their life. So he wasn't pulling punches on it. You know, it wasn't grotesque or whatever thing.
Anything. It was dark though.
It was for kids, but it was also scary.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't do as well as he'd wanted it to. It didn't just like by any you know metric, it just didn't do well.
Yeah.
Even though it's a cult classic now. And they're also making a television series on it right now.
Oh, really?
Currently shooting
of Dark Crystal?
Of the Dark Crystal.
Oh, I don't think I knew that.
On Netflix.
And it's all puppets?
It's all puppets.
Wow.
I'm sure there'll be some CG elements to it.
Yeah.
But they're shooting it in London right now.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Labyrinth followed Dark Crystal.
So the Brian Froud was a designer on that.
Yes.
And so if you see like that look of Labyrinth of the Dark Crystal, and honestly, like what we think of as creature fantasy aesthetic is like a lot of it is born from Brian Froud's designs.
And is that his son as the baby?
Toby Froud is his son. Yes. Who's also
as Toby.
Yeah. He's also a production designer and is working on the current Dark Crystal.
Oh, so he stayed in the business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. I imagine it's pretty cool for him also to see David Bowie sitting on David Bowie's lap.
He has a different relationship to his whole thing because he's been Toby the baby his whole life. So,
yeah, gotcha. A little bit like Ralphie in A Christmas Story.
But I mean, he's super cool. He doesn't like this begrudge it by any means.
You know him?
Yeah, I'm not super well. We've met a couple times. I made a film for Heather Henson, Jim's youngest daughter. She has a company called Handmade Puppet Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great organization that everybody should check out. And they specialize in puppet films that are non-Muppet style, that are just more avant-garde and out there. And she commissions films every year or so and gives a great deal of money to the artists to produce these short films.
Oh, that's great.
And so she commissioned me to make a short film based on the thing that I was designing. And then,
can you see it online?
Yeah.
Plug it.
Actually, you could, it's on filmstruck.com.
Okay.
Which is, has a bunch of other hints and stuff. It's about to leave Filmstruck, but then it'll go on to some other distribution.
What's it called?
Company. Handmade Puppet Dreams is the company.
Okay.
My film is called Hitori. And it's, it means Japanese for alone.
Mm-hmm. So it's, H-I-T-O-R-I.
Uh-huh. And it's about one puppet that's controlled by thousands of puppeteers. So it's all these puppeteers that make up the mountains and the sea and everything just all meshed together.
Uh-huh.
All these hands controlling this one puppet that's white.
That sounds awesome.
Which was actually loosely inspired by the Helping Hand sequence in The Labyrinth.
All right.
Yeah. So, which we'll get into that. So, Toby's cool. So anyway, Brian.
Did you know that he had a thing when you pinched his cheeks when you first met him and he got pissed off?
Anyway,
Gucci Gucci Coo.
I said, "You're the baby."
You're like, I don't know. I think he had a thing about that.
It's like, you grew up. That's so weird. I was just watching you as a baby.
All right. So his dad designed.
Yeah. So Brian. And the way the story goes is that, like, Jim and Brian Froud were like in the limousine after the premiere of The Dark Crystal and just kind of like talking about it. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't as everything we, mm-hmm. we wanted it to be. And then they just started like throwing out ideas in the limousine of from their premiere. And just,
after the premiere of their movie. Wow.
That's like, that's how Jim was always just like going.
Yeah.
And so that's why, honestly, because Dark Crystal didn't do as well, they, okay, we got to get back to our roots, which is like, you know, human and people, like a little bit of comedy, a little bit of like nonsensical.
Some music.
Yeah, music. And so that's why, how the Labyrinth kind of started to get.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I think he considered other musicians for the role before Bowie. Like I heard of Mick Jagger.
Michael Jackson as well.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But you can kind of see it from The Wiz.
Yeah.
You can kind of think about that and be like.
Well, and his, just his whole sense, childlike sense, like, that makes a little more sense, definitely more so than Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
And, but, also, but Bowie, like, there is none other. Like, there could have not been anyone else.
Also,
that sort
Michael
of
Jackson
that.
Stealing a baby might have been problematic years later. So let's be glad that that didn't happen.
The other thing that kind of struck me today was looking at just the production credits of this thing and the writing credits. Like, this is a melding of George Lucas, Jim Henson, and Monty Python.
Yeah.
Because originally written by Terry Jones. I know a lot of people worked on the script afterward, including the great Elaine May, but Terry Jones got the screenwriting credit.
Right.
And it very much, when you watch it, you feel a little bit of that every now and then, of that sort of Python-esque humor.
Yeah, definitely.
So it comes through.
Well, you know, and it's also funny just because of the way that comedy, those two amalgamations of comedy, which is like very physical, sight-gaggy, kind of like, you know, slapsticky at times, all that kind of stuff, especially with the goblins and the other creatures.
Yeah.
Like, it's great. They're just throwing them around.
Uh-huh.
And there's like, in the Dance Magic Dance sequence, there's like chickens.
Yeah.
Like, they're just throwing chickens in the air.
I feel like Henson had a chicken thing. There are chickens in a lot of his work.
Because chickens are fucking funny.
Yeah. It's true.
Like, there's all these stories about, like, especially in the battle sequence where there's just chaos. And they would just get, like, they'd be like, oh, this isn't crazy enough. And they would go down to the store and get a bunch of wind-up toys and like, glue fur to it and just have them go in the background.
Well, that's when this movie comes alive the most, I think, is when it's crowded.
Yeah.
And when the frame is crowded, whether it's like the battle scenes or the very end when she has her little bedroom party.
Yeah.
Which is, we'll get to that, very sweet ending. But when there's a lot going on is when it's really comes alive the most, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And when you see it, you realize, like, wait a minute, this is not CGI.
Yeah.
Like, how do you pull that shit off and choreograph that? It's just so impressive.
Well, you know, going back to the beginning, there is CGI in the film.
Is there?
There's early CGI. The owl.
All right, I was going to ask you about that, because the owl flies in the window.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I assume most people have seen this. The setup of the film, to me, which is sort of one of the beautiful aspects, is it's a very simple premise.
Uh-huh.
Jennifer, a little dough-faced, adorable young Jennifer Connelly.
I think that's probably why I liked the movie initially the most.
Yeah.
It's like,
wow, she's so beautiful.
Yeah. That was my first crush.
Yeah. I think first crush for a lot of people.
Right.
Actually, my first crush was Christy McNichol, which I don't know what that says about me. But she, and also Scott Ippolito's first crush, by the way, was Christy McNichol. We share a first crush.
There you go.
He says hi, by the way. I saw him last night. So the premise is this, this girl you learn just through a simple camera shot that her mother was a stage actress who I guess had passed away. Father's a widower, marries a woman who is... you know, they sort of set her up as the evil stepmom.
Right.
Even though she's probably really not that bad.
Yeah.
But the Henson version of an evil stepmom.
Right, exactly.
And she has a baby brother. She's probably 15 or 16 in the movie, and a little baby brother that she wishes the goblins would take this brother away.
Right.
And they do. And then very simply, now she is faced with the Goblin King, David Bowie, and her goal is to make her way through the labyrinth so she can rescue the baby.
Right.
Find her way to the castle.
Right.
But at the very beginning, this owl flies in the window, and that was one of my first questions for you, was like, what was that? Because it looked real.
Yeah, no, I mean, so there is a combination. So the beginning of it, where the owl is just flying through the credit sequence mm-hmm. in the dark, that is a CG owl.
Okay.
And then once
pretty good for the time.
Yeah, it was. It was. And then you only see it for a couple of seconds as it flaps through.
Which is the key to CG is not
exactly,
to overdo it.
Exactly. And then there's a sequence where it flies through the darkness and like, into the window, or into uh-huh. real life, and then that's a real owl.
Right.
Because then it's, like, flopping crazy and everything.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they sort of get to the story really quickly, like, Bowie floats in that window at, like, the eight-minute mark.
Yeah.
And shout out to Michael Moschen, M-O-S-C-H-E-N, who did all the crystal ball juggling.
Yeah. Yeah, that was crazy. I mean, this is pretty well documented, too, and you can see a lot of this online, but, like, his hands... were just going through David Bowie's body. Like, he basically, David Bowie would keep his hands behind his back, and Michael Moschen would put his arms in between it, and then just, like, doing this juggling. It's essentially juggling, but,
yeah,
these crystal balls, like, floating on his hands, essentially.
Yeah, which is amazing. I mean, it looks, they pull it off. It's that old gag. Instead of clumsily feeding him a banana and smashing it in his face, though, he's doing, like, this really great juggling work.
Right.
So... you know, right from the beginning, there's that little trick they play where you think it's a period piece and like the English countryside. And then, you know, you realize it's modern times. And she's pretty quickly thrown into this this other world, into this labyrinth, this maze. And that's the other thing is like it's a stage set.
Yeah.
And that it works better now than creating this big CG world. Because it feels like a big, grand puppet show.
It, you know, part of what makes it work is everyone's complete and total acceptance of the situation.
Yeah.
There's nobody needs to stop and be like, okay, how is David Bowie? Who is David Bowie? Why is he in this room? Like,
right.
Where did you come from? What's your origin story? Like, all that exposition is just out the fucking window.
It's a like, fairy tale. Yeah, like, you buy into it.
Exactly. It's like, game on, let's go.
Yeah.
Like, and to completely buy into that, then you're already automatically buying into this world because everybody's accepting it.
Yeah.
And also the momentum of the narrative carries that acceptance forward, too, because nobody's really stopping to ask questions.
Right.
Other than how do I get to the center of the labyrinth?
Right. And, of course, she gets various help along the way. The main character, I guess, is Hoggle.
Hoggle, yep.
I thought it was kind of cute. She didn't trick him because she was very upfront about her jewelry being made of plastic. She offers him jewelry to help and said, what is it, plastic? And he's like, oh. Like, I guess in that world, plastic was like, wow, this is amazing.
It's great. Who is also voiced by Brian Henson.
Right, who is a kid. I mean, like early 20s?
This was the first production that he was the puppet captain on it. So generally what you have is when you're working on a big puppet show, you'll have a series of puppeteers and then you'll have somebody who's the puppet captain. And that person works as kind of a puppet director, liaison from them to production, just so they can help choreograph sequences beforehand, before you get on set and all that kind of stuff. Especially if you're working in a puppet that requires multiple people.
Right.
And Hoggle required like 4 to 5 people to operate. So there was the super former inside of it. Uh-huh. There was a female little person.
Right.
And then there was Brian, who was doing some early version of... So I forgot to say that the HDPS system, we refer to those as Waldos.
Okay.
And that's because the first character that used that was named Waldo. But it's essentially an early Waldo, which is, it looks like a puppet, on his hand that just has a series of wires on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people next to him that are moving RC radio control controllers that
yeah.
are using the brows and the cheeks and the blinks and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all sit in a row looking at monitors and have to like choreograph
wow.
the movement of the facial features. And when you work like that together in concert, Walking with Dinosaurs was a little bit like that because there was three puppeteers for each dinosaur. You get into this like symbiosis,
yeah,
like
hive mind
situation.
Yeah.
So it's a little easier than you would able to, it does, not every movement has to be choreographed.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So yeah, that was one of the things where Brian talks about that. And he like laments that was like the first time that he was like working as a professional with his dad.
Right.
Like they were on like equal playing fields. And
that's pretty sweet.
That I really liked. So.
And that's just one character. Like,
yeah,
it's so impressive to realize that five people on that one character,
something like three or four
people.
Yeah.
And then there are shots in this movie where yeah. there's, I feel like 50 different puppets going.
But yes. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Not an exaggeration.
Unbelievable. So the movie progresses, you know, it's like I said, a kind of a simple prospect of her making her way through this labyrinth and maze, and there are the obstacles, and then there are the people that help her from the little worm, which is just so great in that one scene.
Hello.
Which is that just a tiny puppet?
So there was actually different sizes of the puppet, but there was a really tiny version of that.
Uh-huh. For certain shots, I guess.
For some shots, and then for close-ups, there was a slightly larger
gotcha.
Version of it. And we actually, the shop that I work out of, there's another artist named Spencer Muir who built a giant parade style version of that.
Really?
For the Dragon Con a couple years back when it was the 30th anniversary of the Labyrinth. And Karen Pearl, who performed that original puppet, was in the parade too.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah,
that's cool.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, people out there should know, Raymond also does these... really humongous parade puppets.
Uh-huh.
The most impressive one I saw, of course, was the Spaceman.
Right.
Which was, how tall was that thing?
Spaceman was 50 feet tall, but he was on a bouncing arm, a metal arm jib that went into his back, and that was connected to a moving Land Rover.
Yeah.
And so he was able to jump about 25 feet in the air.
And how many people was that operating that?
It's usually about 9 people operating that.
Did you design that thing?
Yeah. I shouldn't say that I like wholly designed. It was an astronaut. Like I knew the idea. I designed the mechanics of the basic premise, and then we R&D'd the rest of it as a group. And so,
unbelievable.
Yeah,
you can see that online probably.
Mm-hmm. It's on my website, ninjapuppetproductions.com.
Yeah, seriously, go check this thing out. It's amazing and so much bigger than I think anyone expected it to be.
And it has lights coming out of its in its visor.
Yeah,
and
man.
On the side
it's
of it,
so
and smoking it, and its fingers move, so it would like jump up and then come back down and like give people high fives.
Where does that thing live?
It lives in my rafters right now of my shop.
Really?
Yeah.
So it can be taken out again and
it's
used
a little.
Or...
This was years ago, so it's in semi-retirement. It would
really?
Need to. It would need to be have a little. Honestly, I just rebuild the thing. That's a problem. Is puppets don't really last as long as you would like them to.
Because it is a real thing.
It is a real thing.
Three dimensions.
In fact, a lot of the, one of our friends, Russ Vick, who was, he was a collaborator and worked with us on Stuff You Should Know a little bit. He was in charge of restoring a lot of those hints and
that's
stuff.
That's right. I remember that.
Yeah. For the Museum of Moving Image in New York, the Smithsonian, and the Center for Puppetry Arts all have exhibits that were donated from Henson. And he was in charge for basically creating the museum-style preservation techniques that you would have to use for puppets.
Man.
Which is just, he's a scientist, man.
Well, and just what a nerve-wracking experience, I bet, to be working. I mean, were those the original?
Yeah, a lot of them were.
Wow.
And like, he would see, like, he found, like, packs of gum inside of some of them.
Really?
Like, the big beetle guys from the Dark Crystal, like, packs of gum from inside of them, and, like, a hearing aid and, like, a... Something
where,
like
the dude inside was just chewing gum and, like, put the gum on a...
Yeah.
Whatever. The interior shoulder.
Yeah, but he's, like, he puts some of the stuff where he, like, vaporizes silicone and then, like, has it, like, fall on the puppets perfectly around it and stuff. Like, he's doing, like, science over there. It's crazy.
Holy shit. That's amazing. All right, so back to Labyrinth. Mm-hmm. The musical bits, it's funny because now, you know, it's kind of that corny 80s stuff, but the addition of Bowie and that voice is what kind of like saves it, I think.
Absolutely.
For an audience today.
Absolutely. Like,
it's still David Bowie.
Dance Magic is like, it's probably one of my favorite Bowie songs, period.
That's great. Yeah, and he's all in, man. Like, he should have kept that hair for his career. It's so cool looking.
Yeah.
Another one of my favorite, and actually this leads to my next question, which is your favorite puppet, but the truly frightening, like the little demon babies on the sticks.
Yeah.
That shit's scary looking. You know? And that's the cool thing about, it is sort of the CGI of the day, because they could, I feel like they could almost build whatever they could imagine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely. They were really good about using the techniques of the day to build, to make these wish fulfillments, you know, to mm-hmm. be able to just make whatever they wanted come to life.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at like Brian Froud's designs mm-hmm. and see the puppets that they made, like, and there's a big coffee table book that came out that's really, really great.
Oh, cool.
That you can go, and it has like little post-it notes of like designs and sketches and all this kind of stuff.
I love that stuff, especially like at the Henson Museum, like when you see the handwritten notes and stuff like that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So you can, all this information you can find there, but like if you see the designs and you see the puppets, it was like, that's what they did.
What was your favorite puppet in this one?
So it's hard. So two things. There's my favorite, like, holy shit moment is the gatekeeper, mm-hmm. the basically mech warrior robot.
The door that became the creature.
Right.
That's badass.
Like that, I remember watching that and like for years after and just being like, I have no idea how they did that.
Yeah.
And
such
I
a cool
and
there, idea.
There's a, as somebody who works in production, and you know enough about movies to where like you're like, okay, I can kind of figure out how they did that,
right?
Especially nowadays with CG, that's one thing. If I can get a little nostalgic, one thing that I miss is the fact that when you see something really cool on movies, uh-huh. there's never a how did they do that?
Yeah,
it's always they did that with computers,
right?
It's like Jaws. Like people thought, or Alien, it was like the question was, how did they do that?
Right.
And you don't have that anymore.
Yeah.
This was a holy shit, how did they do that moment? Yeah. And I'm still not 100% sure how they did it.
Yeah.
But the gates come together, mm-hmm. the doors come together, and it kind of, you can't really tell what it is until it actually meets. And it's a giant mech warrior armor, suit of armor that's just swinging its axe. And it's the size, it's not like a forced perspective or anything.
Right, it's huge.
It's the size that it looks like on stage, on screen. And then
that was a very cool moment.
The best part is there's a little creature underneath it, and he knocks off the head, and he's just like pulling toggles and switches and foot pedals. And he was like, let me go.
Yeah, that's the thing I see a lot of in, is the, not puppet within a puppet, although that mm-hmm. is definitely the case there, but like, the guy with the bird going out of his head. Like, just cool shit like that. Like, the imagination can just really run wild, and they could build it as long as they could figure out how to operate it.
And it was incorporated into the story. That's what's the one of the best things about it is, like, there are some background characters, but all of the characters, for the most part, their aspects of their, what makes them cool creatures, mm-hmm. are integrated into the story.
Yeah.
Like the bird guy and this monster and Bluto, and they do the things that they were designed to do. This creature was designed to do this thing to help fulfill the story.
Right.
Which is great.
Yeah, and was it Bluto? Was that the big guy? Of course, it's sort of a wonderful thing to do in a kid's film to have the kind of the biggest, scariest guy have the softest heart and be sort of a big teddy bear on the inside. The other thing I thought was really funny, just as an adult, is the Bog of Eternal Stench, which sounds like if you ask like a 10-year-old to name a metal album.
Right.
And then when you watch it, it's just a big farty lick.
It's just a bunch of farts.
Yep. It's just a bunch of farts.
Man, the day that farts aren't funny to me is the day I know.
Yep, you're dead inside.
I'm done.
And the little foxy guy riding the dog looks amazing.
Yeah.
And it in the one shot of the bog, it looks like a real dog. Is that the case?
They switch between a real dog and a puppet dog.
And it's all pretty seamless, though.
Yeah. They did that a lot. There's quite a bit of that, of switching between animals. When they do have animals that look, that are supposed to be that type of animal, yeah, they do that pretty well.
Yeah, which you can, I mean, they obviously smartly picked a, like a big sheep dog, which looks like a big puppet anyway.
Right, yeah.
So it's not like they probably couldn't have done that realistically with a, you know, a boxer.
I mean, you could. It's not as, yeah, you can, man, they were doing all kinds of crazy shit. You can.
Yeah. I guess you're right. But at least the sheepdog, like the kind of the face is hidden and there's just like a big mop of hair.
I tell you what, the creature shop in and at Henson, a lot of what they do now is they do that animal stuff.
Uh-huh.
Like the big lion in The Hangover, that was Henson.
Really?
Yeah. There's like
that wasn't real?
No, there was a tiger.
Some real
tiger.
Shots. Yeah, yeah, tiger.
There were some real shots, but when it was interacting with them, that was a creature.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
You know, Josh and I got approached by them to do a Stuff You Should Know puppet thing.
Oh.
And this was, God, I wish I could remember the guy's name. I'm sure you know him. I can't remember. This was like about 4 years ago.
Mm.
It was post Stuff You Should Know TV show.
Yeah.
Failure. No, I'm not. It was a failure. One season, people are like, the show got canceled? It's like, no, it didn't get renewed. It's different than being canceled.
The non-success.
Yeah. Well, I was proud of what we all did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I can't remember this guy's name, but we had a coffee with him. And I think the hang up was, this was sort of post Stuff You Should Know TV. And I was like, man, I can't.
Yeah.
Like, you wanted me to move to LA for a little while,
right,
or it'd be a travel thing. I was like, I can't do that, man. You know, I got to be around.
Yeah.
And it just sort of fizzled from there. But I meant to tell you back then that we had been talking to those guys. Yeah. About some sort of, no, don't say it's not too late. it's too late.
Well.
The fantasy ball sequence in Labyrinth after she takes LSD, the LSD peach. She eats from the LSD peach. That's where, like, Henson's creativity is, like, it's just on full display with those masks.
Yeah.
Like usually when you see a gown ball with a masked ball,
yeah,
it's just sort of a very basic, like the dramatic mask with the big nose. But
right.
These are just off the charts, cool looking.
Yeah. You know, that's a beautiful sequence. And actually, a lot of people, when they go, when they have Labyrinth parties, that's what they do. Actually, the Center for Puppetry Arts has a Labyrinth ball.
That does not surprise me.
For Dragon Con.
And
people go to town on that.
Yeah.
It's crazy. We actually built a bunch of masks for the TV show Atlanta this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for their Helen episode.
I haven't seen the new season
yet. This new season's great. And they go to Helen, Georgia, and they have this
Helen, Georgia?
Yeah, they go have this, this German festival, and everybody's wearing masks, and they're all creepy and weird as fuck. And so we took We built about, 30 or 40 masks for them, and we took some inspiration from that sequence, definitely, from the Labyrinth.
Yeah, so for those of you listening, Helen, Georgia is in the mountains of North Georgia, and I don't know the history behind it, but at some point somebody decided, let's build a, Austrian-German Alpine town in North Georgia. And so it's a massive tourist trap, but I grew up going there like crazy and just thought it was the coolest thing ever, you know?
I've still have yet to go there.
Oh, really?
I've never been there. And, even reading the script when they were telling me, I was like, is this real? Did they just make this up for the show? But,
Yeah, Raymond, you could go and get a handmade spindle top. You could get some homemade fudge and a very ironic old-timey Civil War photo of yourself.
That's amazing. All right. So
I don't know if they still have that stuff. I bet they do, knowing Helen, Georgia.
Yeah.
I camp a lot around there, though. Camping's probably not your jam, though, is it?
Nah.
No.
Certainly not in Helen.
It's funny, I have on my notes, the door that becomes a creature with, two exclamation points. So at the end of the film, it resolves itself very sweetly when, in an empowering way, too, where Jennifer Connelly's character realizes that the Goblin King has no power over her.
Right.
She has kind of solved all these in the true hero's journey with the help of her buddies, has solved all these riddles almost in the final kind of M.C. Escher-esque set.
Yeah.
Which is very cool looking.
It's amazing.
And I have no idea really how they did that, actually.
Yeah, I tell you, man, I definitely encourage people to go and find the behind-the-scenes stuff on this. But there's rigs that have David Bowie that have a rod going up his back that has a harness around his chest that is on a pivot that basically makes him be able to just rotate up.
So they did that shit in real, like...
Some of it. Wow. Like, the wide shots where he is, like, you see him just, like, coming up and getting onto his feet like that.
Wow.
Like, yeah, it's crazy.
That's really cool.
Obviously, it was a lot of, you know, force perspective and match shots.
Yeah, yeah.
Too, but yeah.
That's awesome. And then, you know, it has a very sweet ending where she's saying goodbye to her friends that she had met along the way. And says that, you know, she wants to stay buddies, basically.
Should you need us.
Yeah, and she's like, I do. I will need you.
I do.
And it just has that very fun, playful kind of slumber party scene at the very end where they're all in her bedroom.
Right.
And visually, that's such a great scene again because there's so much going on.
You know, it's also in great contrast because going back to the very beginning, the first time we see the puppets is jarring and terrifying.
Yeah, the goblins with all their faces
it's
in the screen.
Full screen. Uh-huh. Like, it's cut to, like, this normal, like, girl's bedroom.
Uh-huh.
Smash cut to about, like, 24 goblins, all full screen, grotesque looking.
Yeah.
Looking straight into the camera.
Yeah.
Being like, did she say it?
Right, right.
And looking around and stuff, and you're just like, whoa!
it's pretty jarring.
That.
Yeah.
That's one of my, like, the scare, like, I remember that, seeing that as a kid and being like,
Yeah.
And then, but like in contrast to that, to the seeing all the characters in her bedroom, just jumping around.
Yeah.
Was also
having a good time.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Well, we finish up with two segments, as you know, because you've listened a little bit. What Ebert said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
And then five questions. Roger Ebert didn't love this movie. And I'm going to read a part of this because I think he fucked this up, which makes me mad. Because he says this, and correct me if I'm wrong, he says, one of the key characters in the film is Toby, and that's the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, played by Toby Froude, and he said, Froude is a midget, of course he uses that word because it's in the 80s,
right?
Who has been given a Muppet head to wear, and although the head is good special effects, I keep wanting the real eyes and real expressions. The effects didn't add anything. He's wrong. He's talking about
Hoggle.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's no.
That's almost unforgivable to as a professional. And I love Roger Ebert, which is why I read his stuff. But like he completely mixed up like the character names in print.
Yeah.
In his own column.
Yeah. That's really that's wrong.
Very.
And also he's just that's a poor assessment of the situation.
Well, and that. Yeah, because to me, one of the I had a note on here. One of the cool things about this, to me, are and one of the things that make the puppets so engaging is the eyes.
Yeah,
I think they do such a great job with the
eyes.
They all look real.
Yeah,
and this is the point where they're like blinking and You know, I think the eyes are what really draw you in.
And it's like not a human. Like, that's an important part of the character of Hoggle, is the fact that it could have just been some random dude. And, like, to achieve that level of makeup effects back then, you would have had so much on his face, all you would have seen was the eyes.
Right.
That would have been the only human part of that makeup.
And looked phony.
Yeah. Like, you wouldn't have the cheek movement or anything else. That you had. So
Ebert, wrong.
Wrong.
Two counts.
Wrong.
And then he has this to say, another problem with the movie is too long. It's, by the way, like 94 minutes long. without a strong plot line to pull us through, all movies like this run the danger of becoming a series of incidents. There's no structure to the order of the adventures. She does this, she does that. She's almost killed here, almost trapped there. And till at last, nothing much matters. Great energy and creativity went to the construction, production, and direction, but it doesn't have a story that does justice. So, Roger Ebert, RIP, but I didn't know that you were dead inside in 1986.
Yeah. I will say Jim was not a big, this is my opinion. Jim Henson was not a big, like, traditional structure storyteller.
Uh-huh.
You know, his stuff was a series of, he was a sketch artist. Like, he comes from that genre. So, like, and even in the writing process of this, you could see that, like, they were very interested in the design aspects of it. And the idea of a traditional narrative arc wasn't at the forefront of their mind when they were creating this.
Well, it's not a it's not an Academy Award winning script,
right?
But it's a movie for kids, which had a very simple through line,
right?
And a very traditional, again, hero's journey.
Yeah,
and like it's that story's been around.
And I will say that I think
since the beginning of time.
As a caveat, I think it's more of a I would say it's a family movie, not specifically for kids.
Good point.
And that's something that like Jim and like going back to like what the conflicts in his life, he never wanted to be just a kid's artist.
Right.
In fact, he almost didn't do Sesame Street because he was afraid that it was going to pigeonhole him in children's theater.
Yeah, and his early stuff, I remember when we did the podcast, was, what was the early show called that was a little sort of...
The original
Bawdy and Racy.
The original title of The Muppet Show was Sex and Violence.
Right, that's it.
And it was called Sex and Violence.
Yeah. Hysterical.
So he was an adult that had, like... stuff, you know.
Two thumbs up. We give Ebert two middle fingers today in this room, everybody. All right, and we finish with five questions with Raymond Carr.
All right.
What is the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
Oh, my God. The first movie I remember seeing in the theater was probably Ghostbusters, and we lasted about until the library scene.
Okay.
And
got scared.
It's when the ghosts like turned to camera and started yelling at them.
Uh-huh.
My brother and I screamed and ran out of the theater.
That's
and
adorable.
My parents got their money back.
First R-rated movie you remember seeing?
Terminator 2.
Oh.
Definitely. It's funny. My brother, my parents were like, oh, your brother's old enough. He was like 13.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, he's older. Let's go take him to an R-rated movie.
So and you got grandfathered in?
Yeah, but then they took me too. It's
right.
Like I wasn't old enough. I still love that movie. It was great.
Yeah, it holds up. We were just talking about that the other day in a mini crush that Robert Patrick's like the silver goo, like that still looks pretty good.
Yeah,
you
the
know?
Movie is damn near perfect.
Yeah. Will you walk out of a bad movie?
No, not now. Especially not now. Just because movies are A, expensive, mm-hmm. and B, I go to the theater so rarely these days.
You know, it's you pick a good one.
And also, like, I'm, like, it's not like I'm so busy that I'm got to get my last, like, 5 minutes. And I just like stories in general. So,
yeah.
And there's going to be some redeeming quality in it. So.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm kind of there, too. Like, you don't take a flyer anymore. Like,
oh,
maybe this will be good.
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm going to go see Infinity War or Black Panther because I know that
exactly
those are going to be great.
Yeah.
Although I did see the fucking Justice League movie. And I should have walked out. Scotty and I were talking about that last night, man. How does DC get it so wrong
when
Marvel is just destroying
it? Because there's a whole other conversation.
I know.
Yeah,
that's a whole different show. It's a whole other podcast. I'm going to do a Raymond-specific question number four. Dream puppet job. Like what puppet do you wish you had been the operator for in history?
In history?
Yeah. Not like dream job in the future.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that I would have loved to have been on Alien Queen Mother.
Whoa.
Yeah.
All right. I thought you were going to say, like, I wanted to be Fozzie Bear.
No. Look, I've been... The part of it is because I know that I'm not talented enough to do Fozzie Bear. Which
is not true, by the way.
Well, whatever. But like, I've always loved I've always been a spectacle guy.
Uh-huh.
Like, I love the comedy and the silliness, but like, I've always been a spectacle guy. And like,
that and the melding of sci-fi.
Like,
of course.
Yeah, man, that thing is just a spectacle to behold. And like, even if you like go into watch like YouTube of like behind the scenes of that thing, just seeing that thing just come to life, is just amazing.
All right, boy, that's a good answer. And then finally, movie going 101. What's your jam in the theater? Where do you sit? What do you get at the concession stand? What's your ritual?
All right, so I definitely have a Pavlovian addiction to popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even if I've had a full meal, I still have to have a popcorn, and I'm sick by the end of the movie.
Yes.
I'll usually get a Sprite, or if I am maybe an adult beverage if they have it there.
Okay.
And then I like to be front center. So like I go to IMAX. If I'm in IMAX, I would like the movie to be literally the maximum view of my eyes.
Uh-huh.
And if it's the same with movie theaters, I won't be like on the front, But it doesn't make sense to me to sit in the back of the theater. Uh-huh. Then why don't you just watch it at home if you're going to be all the way back there?
So like in a stadium seating, are you in the stadium part or are you down on the lower part where it's still flat?
I'm in the back of the lower part.
Okay, gotcha.
So I don't have to crank my head very much,
uh-huh.
but I am also like getting the maximum view of the thing.
Gotcha.
I want to stick my head inside of the movie.
What a perfect way to end. Good stuff, man.
Absolutely.
I appreciate this. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. How fun was that? Holy cow. Man, I felt like we could have gone on forever. Ray is such a cool guy. And just a real pleasure to have him in here and catch up with him. And just amazing, man. You really need to go online and check out the stuff that he's done, especially that Spaceman that we talked about. It's just astounding, the level of talent that that Raymond has. Go to ninjapuppetproductions.com to see all his work. And hopefully you've seen some of his work on PBS or anything else he's doing. He's just a good fella. And I'm glad I can count him as a friend. So it was very nice of him to stop by and take time out of his busy schedule and give me the lowdown on the craft of puppetry, which is really, really impressive. Very cool stuff. And we're also proud of Raymond that he made it to the bigs and he's working with the Henson Company. It's just really, really cool to see him thriving like this. So that is it for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. And we will see you next time. And until then, why don't you stick your hand up a puppet and see what happens? Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.